It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Leo's off today, but Andy Anatko, Serenity Caldwell, and Allison Sheridan are all here. We're going to talk about Apple lawsuits, Apple patents, and Apple's problems in the education market. It's all coming up right now on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 431 for December 2nd, 2014. iPhone lands on its feet. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter the offer code MacBreak at checkout to get 10% off. And by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting snacks right to your door. Start snacking smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like lemon tea biscuits. To get your complimentary NatureBox sampler, visit naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover Apple in all its glory. Leo is out today. My name is Mike Elgin. I'm the news director here at Twit. And with us is the incomparable Andy Anatko, Chicago Sun-Times technology columns. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing pretty good. People do compare me to other things, usually not in a positive way. So thank you for brushing that over. If I'm incomparable, that can be nothing but an upgrade. I don't like being compared to things because...
Well, I will try to not do that. And in fact, I would have never done it. I would never do that. I really enjoy your work. Really enjoy all your appearances on this show. And also, I'm going to make a pitch right now. I'd love to get you on Tech News Today much more often. I think this year you've only been on the show once, twice, three times. But I'd really love to get you on that show more.
I've loved it every time I've done it. I'm just here darning socks by the fire waiting for that phone to call, Mike.
All right, we're going to send you a special red phone that lights up when I call. So that'll be a lot of fun. And with us also,
because I usually am dressed as Batman. So
really? That's perfect.
Now I'll have a reason to do that.
Absolutely perfect. Goes with the cave. And with us today is Serenity Caldwell, panelist on the Incomparable podcast, and also iMore managing editor. Right?
Yes, that is correct. I'm happy to be here filling in for Renee and other erstwhile podcasters. That's fun. Please don't mind the slightly strange appearance behind me. I am podcasting from a basement, but it does have extraordinarily good Wi-Fi. So
it doesn't look like a basement. It looks like an attic. What are you going to do? But it's so. Correct me if I'm wrong. The job title of managing editor is the best job in all of editorialdom. Am I right or am I wrong? Oh, great. We're having Skype issues.
I'm pretty sure just mentioning anything about Wi-Fi is enough to set it off.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Serenity. We didn't hear that. Skype sort of collapsed on us a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's lagged. Here, let me do a quick reconnect.
Okay. Pretty much. I quite like my new title.
Okay, yeah, we're getting
that
serious.
That was a great like freeze frame. Yay!
All right, let me work on this.
It's like an Agatha Christie story where first there were four panelists, and now Renee's gone, and now Alex is gone, and Leo's gone, down to just I must be the murderer then because I've lured people to like this Swiss chalet. Say yes, we need some substitutes for the podcast. Don't question yourself about whatever happened to Leo and to Renee. It was perfectly normal things that happened. Oh, listen to you with your fanciful things about how nobody just simply gets impaled upon a brass candlestick when they're skiing outside.
That's a imagine. Painful image. Thank you so much for that, Andy. So do we have Serenity? Let's check this.
Is this working again?
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, there we go.
Look at that. Wow, it's a Skype miracle. I was asking you if managing editor, which I found to be one of the greatest jobs ever in editorial work, and I was asking you how you like being a managing editor.
I quite like being a managing editor. You know, when Renee first hired me on at iMore, he's like, well, you know, titles, they're just kind of, you know, you're welcome to choose what you want. But we were thinking like managing editor iOS. I'm like, no, I don't need to choose. That sounds great.
Yeah.
That sounds fantastic. So I'm quite enjoying it. And it does have a kind of all encompassing feel to it, which I think aptly describes some of the stuff that I've done so far in the first couple months. Just, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, editorial or proofing, editorializing, taking some video,
yep.
All over the board.
Managing editors are the only people in an editorial operation that know everything and have all the power. So that's why it's such a fantastic job. Well, let's jump into the Apple news. We've got some Apple news, not a whole lot. This is one of the weird things about covering Apple is that they're not like Google, which is always constantly leaking out bits of news and information. Apple releases official news 2-3 times a year, something like that. And then the rest of the year, we're all on our own to scramble and figure things out. And we rely on the goodness of people to file lawsuits against Apple so that we have something to talk about. So Apple's in court today, and they are faced with a $1 billion lawsuit, class action suit over iPods and music stuff. And it's actually a $350 million lawsuit, but it gets tripled because there's an antitrust dimension to it. Andy Anatko, I couldn't really get a sense of the outcome of this, whether they're going to win this or lose it. Can you do us the favor of just encapsulating what this lawsuit is actually about, and then maybe give us your sense of whether Apple's going to have to actually pay that $1 billion.
That's the thing with like lawsuits with Apple. They're fighting so many battles on so many fronts. You kind of have to. It's like you can't follow every single sports team. You kind of cheer for the one that you really really like. So I'm a big fan of the interconference scrabbling between Apple and Samsung and Apple and the book industry. When it comes to this thing about antitrust stuff on music players, I really don't know what the real beef is. I have to absolutely admit that this is one of those things that makes my eyes glass over a little bit.
Yeah, and Serenity Caldwell, one of the interesting things about this is that, of course, Steve Jobs is going to testify, sort of. He's actually going to be a video, a deposition of Steve Jobs himself, which was recorded probably 4 years ago, something like that, is going to be played in court. And, you know, it's going to, I think we're all looking forward to seeing it. He's probably going to be very persuasive, as he always is. And, you know, it's just kind of a weird aspect to this that Steve Jobs is testifying.
Yeah, you know, I think it's funny that, you know, Steve probably in his infinite wisdom is like, you know what, on the off chance that we get sued, I'm just going to make a bunch of video testimonials and I'll be extremely compelling in all of them. No, but I believe the video is of boardroom meetings or something along those lines where he's talking about the various plans for the iPod and about crushing competitors, which, of course, this lawsuit has taken to meaning, oh, well, the iPod is clearly, you know, antitrust and its goal is to, you know, make sure there are no other competitors in the music space. And I don't know. I mean, not having seen the videos myself, and maybe they'll leak out after the court testimony, I'm skeptical to believe that what Jobs was actually like in the ebook, the ebook antitrust suit. I'm not necessarily sure what he was saying is let's crush all the competitors. More like we have a better product and we're going to make it the best product in his traditional Steve Jobs way. Yeah. Now, whether that will be helpful or harmful for this case, we shall see, I suppose.
It's also weird. Go ahead, Andy.
I'm just saying. Also, this is where like non-lawyers like myself. This is why our eyes glass over. A lot of the things that are sort of key to this particular suit are the idea that for a time you had to, if you wanted music that worked with iPods, you had to buy music from Apple. And so, does that to us? That's more like maybe we've been beaten down our expectations of having freedom with non-DRM'd content. But now it's like, well, of course, if I buy a Kindle book, I'm not necessarily going to be able to get it on a player that has not been approved by Kindle. If I buy an iTunes movie, I'm going to have to be limited to Apple TV and the Apple iPhone and the Apple iPad and that sort of stuff. And then you just have to wonder, well, why is the government so worried about it? And this is why, like I say before, my eyes kind of glass over because I don't know at this point the difference between something that we should simply accept because this is the way that business wants to do business, and something that the government really does say, no, we're here to defend you by saying you shouldn't tolerate that sort of stuff from happening. And the other, pardon me, and the other reason why your eyes glass over is that you know that even if things come down, a judgment comes down on the side of the consumers, it's going to be something like we suddenly get a credit for $1.73 appear magically in our account, and like, well, congratulations, that was the result of all this lawyers and all this gas being burned to photocopy documents and get depositions. $1.73, go nuts.
It's also it's weird, of course, that Steve Jobs is going to make a sort of virtual appearance in all this. But it's no less weird that the subject matter of this is this whole topic about music players and iPods and lock in for iTunes Music and so on. It's almost as if Microsoft were going to court today to defend itself against charges that its dominance in Windows is allowing it to maintain its dominance with the Internet Explorer browser, and then they're all going to go to court and figure out this issue once and for all. It's the whole thing is gone. It's over, and it's just a question of whether people get that dollar and change in their accounts. And so it is a bizarre thing that should make everybody's eyes glaze over, not just the non-lawyers.
It's also something that I'm glad that some of the stuff that I might have like posted on my blog or like written about like in the 1990s, back when the government might possibly have broken Microsoft into separate units for their operating system division, their application division, and their services divisions, because they're just so powerful, and it was incorrect for them to create an ecosystem in which their own products work together better than an outside product would. And I'm sure that I was also like, 15, 20 years younger then. And so maybe 21, 22-year-old Andy would have said, this is exactly what needs to happen because Microsoft wants to control everything and do everything. But now, like, I'm Andy into my 40s and saying that, okay, I'm not necessarily saying it's a good thing that I can't buy this copy of the Lego movie and play it anywhere. But, Apple does such a wonderful job with its iCloud integration to make sure that syncing between devices works so very, very well. And it's like, you just don't know what's real and what's unreal anymore. And I don't even know like whether the blue pill or the red pill is the one that I'm supposed to take to get back to reality.
I'm as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to remember nothing. Serenity, you had a comment?
Oh, just the fact again, like you were saying, Mike, about the Internet Explorer days, iPods, were locked in primarily because of hardware issues. When you're talking about early syncing problems, we all remember how much fun it was to sync early iPods and early music players to your computer. Whereas now, there's a reason why this lawsuit is capped at like 2008, 2009, because once the App Store was introduced and everything else, like, yes, you have the option to buy from the iTunes Music Store, but you also have apps like Amazon Music, where you maybe not necessarily can buy directly, but you can get your music downloaded. You can put your music on Dropbox. You can have your music accessible via Google Play. You can stream it off of YouTube. Like these concerns are now no longer concerns. So it's not like it's not like this lawsuit is stop the big bad Apple that's keeping us from doing everything that we want to do. I mean, most of those options are available. Alternate options are available to you now.
Yep,
it's still an interesting principle. Like one of the central things, and one of the reasons why I think this has gone so long is because Steve Jobs is known for saying things that are on his mind, and whatever happens, then happens. And there's a conversation between him and Phil Schiller. Is it Phil Schiller? I think where I beg your pardon. Where they're talking about one of the central touch match issues here was when Real Player wanted to get its content on the iPod, Apple would not let them do that. So they found a way to do that. They simply reverse. I don't know if this fits the legal definition of reverse engineering, but they figured out that hey, there's a way that we can actually do that, whether Apple wants us to do it or not. And then Apple said, okay, or we can change the way that a host computer talks to the iPod to make sure that doesn't work ever again. And that's one of the central issues that these suits are based on. And it's an interesting question to ask. Like, is it bullying tactics if Apple says this application that an independent consumer may or may not choose to install, that may or may not affect the operation of only the hardware that he or she actually owns, should we actually actively move to make sure that that tool is not available to that person? Even though it doesn't seem to be breaking any laws, there's no violation of Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's not breaking copy protection on anything that we sell, is it bullying for Apple to say, no, we emphatically say that as a consumer, you do not get to use any software on here that we do not approve. And you certainly can't sell software as a company that lets people use our hardware in a way that we did not envision, in a way that we don't approve of. So I think it's a more interesting debate amongst people like us who talk about this than amongst lawyers, because when lawyers get involved, that starts to have knock-on effects that maybe you don't like 5 or 10 years later. But it's, like I was saying earlier, I think it's an interesting issue that things that we thought maybe were incredibly important in the 1990s, we simply accept as the law of the land, simply by virtue of the fact that we like the good things about the kingdom that we live in. It's okay if they occasionally catapult people over the moat that we were kind of fond of.
Yeah, exactly. And the companies that are often subject to lawsuits and also antitrust action by the government tend to bristle about it, because they understand something that this case actually demonstrates, something that we referred to the Microsoft case in the 90s, that demonstrates it as well, which is that innovation will always clobber you anyway. It's not like, it's very, very difficult to get a lock-in unless you're Facebook, in which case, when you have every social, almost every social network, one-third of the internet users in the world, and it's very difficult for them to sort of lose their monopoly, if you want to call it that. But yeah. But things like, browsers, music players. I mean, nobody, I don't think, could have predicted the degree to which streaming services would replace the behavior of buying songs and downloading them to the extent that it is happening now, and to the extent that it's almost certainly going to happen in the future. That's just the industry being innovative and moving on with new ways of doing things, and people embracing new ways of doing things, invalidating the old sort of lock-in model that this case is all about. It's also a big question about how you slice and dice and categorize things. Does Apple have a 100% monopoly in iOS market share, or do they have a 50% monopoly in the United States market because the iPhone has something like that in terms of its market share? Or do they have a significantly lower market share globally? How do you slice and dice these things? How do you determine what the market is and so on? So it's annoying when the lawyers get in there and start making these distinctions. But it's really, I think, Apple, as Apple will attest, these questions are almost always resolved not by antitrust legislation, lawsuits, or the government, but by the markets, the innovative competitors, and the users themselves, who choose different models for doing things. And so, that's why these companies have to constantly reinvent themselves. Well, Apple is a company in flux, and it's really interesting to see, and it's one of my favorite topics to sort of look for signs of the new Apple, the new Tim Cook, the warmer, the fuzzier Apple, the less vindictive, the one without the thermonuclear war, that Apple. And so I think we're seeing another sign of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Serenity Caldwell, that, in Apple's Red campaign, which is where their everything that they sold on Cyber Monday yesterday went, all the money raised went to help fight AIDS. And an interesting element of this is that they're pushing this so hard that they literally pushed a push notification out to people, which caused people to freak out and think, okay, this must be a spear phishing attack or something else. What do you think about this? Is this Red campaign a sign of an Apple that's more willing to do good things in the world? Or is this just the same old Apple, something that's existed before?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that they've been doing the Red campaign for quite a few years now. And this campaign, we're going to brand all of our apps red and encourage people to buy apps during World AIDS Day and donate our profits. That's a step above from what they're normally doing. The push notification issue is a little thorny because on one hand, there are a lot of us who are very upset when apps that we buy send push notifications that are ads, right? You should buy this in-app purchase, or everything is 30% off today. All of that kind of stuff, that's really annoying when you get it from everywhere else. So to say that Apple is immune from that, even when it's for a good cause, is kind of a hard tack to take. But at the same time, I don't think it was meant maliciously, and I don't think it's the harbinger of things to come from Apple where they're like, oh, hey, let's use our push notification system for ads all the time. I think that it was probably one or two people in on the App Store team or somewhere in that who were like, oh, you know, it would be really cool as part of our, you know, promotion of World AIDS Day. Let's make sure that all of our customers really know about it and make sure that they understand, you know, this great cause that we're supporting. So it's like it's I don't necessarily think that Apple should continue to use push notifications for ad or charity related reasons. But I understand the vein from which they were coming. And I don't necessarily think the outrage, the subsequent outrage on the internet is necessarily justified. It's like, yeah, they made a mistake. They made a mistake in Concert for a Good Cause. And now, you know, they've definitely understood that people are maybe not so thrilled with this mistake that they've made. And maybe they won't do it next year for World AIDS Day.
And do you see other indications that Apple is getting both warmer and fuzzier?
Oh, yeah. I mean.
Oh, sorry.
I just
wanted to pick up where Cerny was talking about. It's an interesting move for I wasn't outraged by it. I just thought it was okay. Well, that's interesting. I've never seen an alert like that. I think that it is important to note that this isn't an ad so much as this is an extension of Apple's beliefs that we want to do this, take this step to promote something that we really, really like. Also, I think it's also important to note that they didn't do it at like 2:20 p.m. on like a business day. It was during a long weekend where pretty much nobody is really using their phones for anything business related or really, really important, unless, you know, their car is on fire and they're trying to get 911. So maybe there are exceptions to that. But it's interesting that it you could take this as a sign that Apple really does see their users as a community of people that have shared beliefs and shared values. Because think about how many iPhones there are out there. And everybody in this conversation has a certain number of people who follow them on Twitter, follow them on Google Plus or whatever. And you notice as your community grew, you start to notice that things that you could say about, wow, isn't it great that the president of the United States like was happening along and pulled that child out of the tree before the leopard got at him. When you have 2,000 followers, people are going to say, yes, isn't it great that kid's life got saved? When you have 2 million followers, you know what? Let's find out how that kid got in that tree to begin with. You know, I don't subscribe to you for political propaganda. And so it's interesting when Apple chooses to say, we're going to not just simply promote the idea of charity or a unified fund. We're going to promote a specific charity. We're going to push that out to all of our users. So I do think that it is a sign that somewhere inside Apple, there are people that still think that everybody who has bought an Apple device did it because they have a sort of shared values thing going on with the company and with all other Apple users.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we are actually joined by another third panelist. With us right now is Allison Sheridan. Welcome to you, Allison.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. It's very nice to meet you. I have also never been on a podcast or a netcast with you, and so I'm very glad to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on.
That happened
at the last minute. Yeah, you're with the NozillaCast Mac podcast. Can you tell us about that podcast?
Yeah, it's my tagline is a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. In other words, like a giant Mac bias, but
yep.
But I cover a lot of other tech stuff. In fact, this Sunday is my 500th show.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. Well, congratulations and welcome to you. And I'm so glad you're here to join us. Now we have a true quorum here on
Mac Break Weekly. We can call it a panel.
Yeah, exactly. And so I want to launch into this next story because it's really interesting. I've always been fascinated by Apple's ebooks initiative and the litigation that they're dealing with. And Eddie Q actually had an interview with Fortune this week where he talked about the need for Apple to fight for the truth, he says. And he said that Tim feels exactly the way he does, but they have to fight for the truth, fight for their principles, because it's the right thing to do. I think that price fixing is not normally viewed as fighting for the truth, but I think they do have a point. And I think the larger point, of course, is that Amazon is the dominant ebook player. They have a lock on the market. They do all kinds of things that smell and taste anti-competitive, which is that they sometimes sell ebooks at below the price that they paid for them, and they tend to be very, very dominant. And I think Apple is trying to figure out a way where publishers and the company that delivers them, i.e. Apple, gets paid a reasonable amount for books. Do you think that Eddie Q's sort of missionary zeal is well-placed here and that it will help Apple in any way deal with this litigation that they're facing?
I'm sorry, are you addressing me or...
Go ahead, Andy. You already started talking. I'm going to go around the horn on this one, but let's start with you, Andy. Go ahead.
I mean to leap in. I think it really does point to how Apple does seem is like one of the few companies that can take things personally. Like it's not when Google revised Android in response to the iPhone, it wasn't a case of one company creating a product designed to be more competitive with a successful other product. It was Google has screwed us over. We trusted Google, and this is what Google did. Google has made a powerful enemy today. And when you look at this antitrust thing, it seems to be mostly based not on. I think that when Eddie Q made that statement, I think he was talking more about how the judge who heard this case concluded that Apple had colluded with publishers to fix prices when in reality they were just getting the iBook store off the ground. One interesting new quote from this from all this is that it's not as though the iPad and the iBook store were packaged together from the very beginning as, hey, if we do a tablet, doesn't it make sense for us to start selling books in the iTunes store? No, it was Eddie Q who puts together all these deals for content, who basically came to Steve Jobs when the iPad was in development and said, hey, here's an opportunity here. And one quote from the article is that Steve said, well, we're not going to delay the iPad for this, but see what you can put together, which makes it seem like this is just, let's see what we can do just in time to get this timed with at least for the iPad. And so I think that what Eddie is saying here, I could be wrong, is that he's saying that, no, look, you went after these publishers because there was a good documented trail of them colluding together to try to provide a united front against Amazon. You're throwing us in with them when actually they did all that before we even got seriously interested in the ebook business. And so we want to defend the truth that we did not join a big cabal to try to fix prices. Now, whether or not that's actually true, whether or not whatever they did apart on their own was price fixing or not, that might be something that's going to be discussed in a week or two when this case is reheard. But it is, I do think that's so typically Apple, and I think in a positive way, that they do feel as though they are one living organism with a heart and a brain and the ability to get offended and hurt. And when they get hurt, they try to say, hey, man, what was that? What was that? Yeah. When you cut me, do I not bleed? Well, no, I don't because I'm a corporation, but still, metaphorically.
Corporations are people, Andy. At least that's what the United States wants us to think.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, Andy, part of what you said there at the very end where you said whether or not that ends up being true, isn't it probably true that anybody going into a lawsuit like this or almost any kind of court battle believes that what they know is the truth? I mean, it almost seems obvious that he say we're defending the truth. Oh no, the other guys, they think they're lying and they're defending lies. That's probably what nobody thinks, right?
Exactly.
I don't know. Sometimes you feel it's like you get pulled over. You know you were speeding. Okay, there's no way that I was doing 65 on that downhill straightaway late at night with no other cars on the road. There's no way I was doing 65, but you know that. The game's over if I say, yes, officer, I was definitely speeding. I wasn't even paying attention to the speedometer, but the trees behind me were complete Brownian motion, a complete Doppler blur into the red there. So whatever you say that I've sped at, that's the ticket you're going to have to write for me. You're going to say, no, officer, I don't know why you pulled me over. And you're going to say, even if they said, you know, there's a lot of leeway on what we might have done something that that fits the colloquial version of price fixing, meaning, yes, we talked to these people and then we encouraged those people to talk to those people and then we all agreed to do this versus we did something that fits the legal definition of price fixing. Like, I did not have relations with that woman. Nope. When the truth comes out, how do you define relations? There you go. So I didn't lie. I just simply said something that I knew that I could defend.
Depends on what the definition of is. But Serenity, you had a comment on that?
I was going to say it's the Obi-Wan Kenobi philosophy. It's like what I told you was true from a certain point of view. You have to believe that if you're defending a case, you have to have a narrative that you strongly believe in
the Costanza defense. Now remember, Jerry, it's not a lie if you believe it to be true.
Yep. No, exactly.
Love a Seinfeld reference. But, yeah, you know, just to zero in on exactly what Apple is saying, and that, you know, to a certain extent, almost all aspects of their of this whole scenario on Apple's part is very acceptable. So, you know, the first aspect of it is that Amazon is very dominant, and there has to be some way for other players to compete with Amazon when Amazon is bringing prices down to a point where nobody's making any money. Okay, that's acceptable. We can all accept that. So so Apple comes forward with saying, hey, we'll just have our regular agency model, the same one we have for apps and everything else. Essentially, you, the publisher, can choose any price you like, and then you give us our massive cut. And then we make money, you make money, you get to determine the price, not us. Amazon determines the price of Amazon eBooks. And Apple's saying, we're going to provide an alternative to that model. I think everybody can accept that that is a perfectly above board thing to do. And then the price fixing part is when they said, but once you've selected a price, you can't sell that same ebook elsewhere, i.e. Amazon.com, for a lower price than the one that's available on, you know, through Apple's, yes. You know. And so and that's the price fixing part. And that's
where the definition of is, because, again, according to the Forbes article, Q's statement was that, look, that was like a draft version of something that we were doing, and we quickly swapped away from that to something else that because we felt as though that language, whether it was legal or not, would not even achieve what we wanted to achieve. So a lot of it really is, here's what the timeline is. The prosecutors also seem to again tinge on things that Steve Jobs tended to say, like shortly after the iPad announcement, again quoting from the Forbes article, that Steve was being asked, like, well, I think it was by Walt Mossberg, that, gee, but Steve, you know, the iBook store is charging $15 for the same book that Amazon is charging $10 for. Who's going to be buying this book for $5 more? And Steve said, soon all the prices will be the same. I realized that he's a tenor, not a baritone, but there's the same ominous sort of, it also sounds bad.
Andy, I'm not a lawyer, and neither are you, so I'll just ask you directly. Yeah. Do you know whether they're allowed to bring up anything about what's going on with the Hachette case and all that with, I guess it's not a case, but with Amazon? I mean, that sort of seems really interesting in this context, but probably has nothing to do with what happened in the past.
I don't know. I mean, we're both non-lawyers, which means that we can go hog wild in speculation.
Make stuff up.
I don't think that they would be able to say, well, here's something that happened 3 years later with parties that had nothing to do with Apple or the other publishers.
A quick look over there. They're being bad.
Hey, we just pushed out an ad that helps AIDS patients. Come on. Could we do anything bad?
Look
how thin the new iPad is, Judge.
this should get us all kinds of credit in court. Just to review the Hachette case, essentially what happened there is that Amazon was accused of bullying tactics. Essentially, they negotiate with publishers to figure out what the price is that Amazon pays for the books that they are then going to sell. This is not the price that they weren't negotiating the price that Amazon is going to sell Hachette books at. That's none of Hachette's business as far as Amazon's concerned. It's the price that Amazon is going to pay. And, of course, they have these negotiations all the time. They have to in order to establish a contract for providing the e-books and so on. And Amazon wanted, apparently, an unacceptably low price. There was protracted negotiations, and Amazon wanted to squeeze. This is the critical version of Amazon. I'll give you the Amazon version in a minute. But the critical version is that Amazon tried to squeeze Hachette by starting to stop making certain titles available on Amazon.com. You couldn't pre-order upcoming books from Hachette. You couldn't, you know, they were starting to squeeze them, literally their bottom line, that the income that was coming through Amazon to Hachette. And it was an effective tactic. People cried foul. A bunch of authors wrote a nasty gram to the Amazon board of directors. And this kind of thing feels anti-competitive. Now, the Amazon's point of view was that, hey, we weren't sure that we were going to actually be able to ink a deal with Hachette. So why would we have pre-orders for books that we are in an uncertain state? They had, you know, language like that. And they also said, you know, ultimately, we're all about embracing literacy. Literacy is enhanced when books are very cheap, and we are there for the reader and the consumer, driving down the prices of e-books so that everybody can afford to read and have the gift of literacy, etc. But Amazon does many, many things that feel anti-competitive and sort of using its monopoly, close to monopoly, whatever you want to call their dominance in the e-book publishing market, and also their dominance in the online print book market, to actually essentially turn the screws on the publishing companies. That feels anti-competitive, but it isn't really. It's not against the law. They're selling books at below cost. Feels anti-competitive, but it's only illegal if you do it internationally. There's nothing against the law about it. If you do it internally, you can lose all the money you want.
That starts making me wonder. I was thinking about it when I got something from Amazon today, and I was like, oh, I only asked for it yesterday, and it came instantly. And I just have this vision that one day after Amazon has dominated absolutely everything, then they're going to go, okay, now we're going to actually start charging what it really costs. And all of a sudden, just everything goes up 20% because it's just too good to be true now.
There were some reports that, in fact, that has happened in certain academic markets where they were able to turn the screws to a certain extent and establish a monopoly on that through low price, but undercutting everybody so nobody else can make money, the prices then went way up. That's a report that was controversial. That's not an absolute statement on what their intentions are in all markets, but there was a report along those lines. Of course, the notorious diapers.com situation where they actually have they had algorithms that monitored diapers.com prices. They wanted to buy diapers.com, and they were in the diapers, you know, competing with them for diapers. And so they had this algorithm that would determine whatever the prices were on diapers.com and then undercut it automatically and instantly. The valuation of diapers.com plummeted, and then Amazon bought them at a very favorable cost because they just didn't have a business anymore because of Amazon. And that's another example of what feels like not entirely fair business practices on the part of Amazon. But again, nothing illegal, and they're benefiting, you know, the cause of keeping babies from having full diapers by driving down the price. Some would say that they are in the same condition as those very diapers.
I'm sure that's how they explain it to stockholders.
Yes.
Like, you know, it's going to cost us money to do this, but think of the children.
At the end of the day, it really comes down to, you know, if there's money being removed from your pockets, like if you're being charged only $5 for something that should cost $10, where is that, like, that other $5 didn't just magically disappear? It's not like, it's not invisible money that you never had to pay in the first place. Oh, this is what the book actually costs or the diaper actually costs. That money is being taken away from either the bottom line of a company or the bottom line of the writer who made the book or from the workers who are packaging your 30 pack of diapers. Like, Amazon may be dramatically undercutting a lot of prices to basically become dominant in this market. And they may be engaging in semi-shady but pseudo-legal tactics to take over companies. But at the end of the day, where is this missing money being taken from? You know, it's like we've all heard stories of like the crazy workers and I've heard stories from small publishers and small publishing companies and even bigger publishing companies who are like, yeah, you know, ebooks should cost, you know, marginally less than a paper book because of printing costs and all of that. But when you look down to it, printing costs really aren't that much. And the majority of the money that you're paying for a book, whether it's printed or ebook, is to help offset like the promotion and the writer's cost and everything else. And the more money you take away from that, the less we're able to pay writers, which means that writers may not be able to write as many books for us in a year. Which then, you know, it trickles through the entire system.
Yes, and Eddie Q wants to fix it. Thank you, Eddie Q, for saving us.
Godspeed.
Yeah, and again, I think like so many of these things, there will be an industry solution to all of this. And, you know, there is the case to be made that Amazon is, in fact, making it super easy for authors to get books into the hands of readers at low cost, and that is theoretically a very good thing. Well, in just a sec, we're going to come back and talk about some really interesting Apple patents, including some crazy Apple patents. We're going to find out what they mean and when they're going to come to an iPhone near you, probably never. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace 7. I've been using Squarespace for several years, and I love it. It's so easy to use, and it's fantastic for me because I'm not the kind of person who's going to go in there and do programming and have to host my site and so on. Squarespace will do the hosting. They let you build programming-free sites. Now, of course, if you're a programmer, if you're a developer, you can go in there and truly customize, get access to all the code, use their amazing developer tools, including the tools that they use to build the site themselves. That developer platform is now out of beta, so you can use that. But they also have this fantastic, easier-to-use system. And, of course, Squarespace 7 is fantastically easy to use. I used to think Squarespace was, like, incredibly easy to use. Squarespace 7 makes it so much easier because, for starters, you don't have to toggle between the preview mode and the site manager. In other words, you don't have to go back and forth saying, okay, I made some changes. Okay, what does it look like? Let me go find out what that looks like. No, you can see what it looks like right there in the editing space, which is really a seamless, fantastic experience. You want pictures? You don't want to just go and grab pictures online somewhere. You want to actually have sites that you have permission to use, but you don't want to spend a fortune, and you want to use high-quality stock photography. So Squarespace now allows you to, directly from inside the site, pick, find, and plug in images from Getty, the stock photography site that is just super, super excellent. It costs just $10 an image. Super simple to do and to use. And those, again, are super high-quality images. They have fantastic templates. Your website on Squarespace will always look incredible because the designers are Squarespace's amazing designers. And it starts with a template, and if you decide you want to switch to another template later, you can swap out the template, and all the stuff that you've done, all the content, the pictures, all the everything in your site will remain the same. You'll just get the shiny new template. And this is really, really a wonderful thing to do. If you ever need help, of course, they have tech support 24/7. They don't send you off to figure it out on your own in some knowledge base somewhere. A human being who knows what they're talking about, who's based in their New York City offices, will answer your question directly. I've used their tech support. I've only had to use it once, in truth. I had a question. It was answered immediately. They really knew what they were talking about. It was really refreshing to use their tech support, and I really, really appreciate that. Squarespace sounds super expensive because of the quality of the designs. It sounds expensive because the ease of use that they give you, and it sounds expensive because their hosting is so amazing. You can't bring down a Squarespace site. Even Leo couldn't bring it down by having the Twit Army on Twit on the Big Sunday Show. He drove everybody, he's done it many times, to Squarespace sites. Nobody can bring these things down because they throw all the processing power that is needed behind these sites when they are stressed. So it's just a fantastic thing. But it's not expensive, just $8 a month. It starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. What a deal. You can start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required. Start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code MACBREAK. That'll get you 10% off and show your support for Mac Break Weekly. And to begin using Squarespace 7, if you're already a user, a customer, just go to the settings tab and you can just activate all the fun new stuff. It's not going to activate on its own, so you won't have everything change unless you want it to change. But believe me, you want it to change. The new stuff is really great. So just go to the settings tab and activate those new features. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Mac Break Weekly. Squarespace, start here and go anywhere. Well, esteemed panel, Apple's got some new patents, including a wacky patent that's designed to make your iPhone act like a cat. So when you drop it, it flips around to land on its feet, so to speak. It lands on the bumper instead of the screen. It supposedly uses the built-in, I guess it's an actuator for the haptics hardware that's inside iPhones, and it sort of turns itself around. Are they crazy? Can anyone imagine this ever working?
I'm actually a mechanical engineer.
First of all, I just want to highlight.
Go ahead, Serenity.
Who wins?
Oh yeah, I was just going to make a joke about how that patent looks like the internals of a lightsaber, not a shifting iPhone in midair. I thought that was amusing, but I think it's a really interesting idea. I think that potentially there might be internals in there, but that can detect falls and compensate accordingly. In this small of a package, though, I'm not quite sure. You want to chime in a little bit more with your electrical engineering background?
Not electrical, mechanical, actually. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think with a certain length of time, I could probably figure out how to do this with you know, the actuator that Mike talked about and, you know, all kinds of different components. But making that in the thickness of an iPhone, I could probably do it in about a 4 or 5 inch thick piece of material. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. But I don't know, maybe they're going to have nanotechnology in there by the time that they get around to actually making something like this.
Well, so we got a phone that in the future that's going to be made out of sapphire. The metal parts are going to be liquid metal, according to previous patents, and we're continuing to speculate. I think you have an interesting idea though there. Like, what if someone were to, like, this would be a crazy Kickstarter, of course, but to make a protective case that not only has an extended battery, but also has like higher powered actuators that could do really cool things. Like, for instance, actually give you a really good chance at landing, if you drop a phone, landing it in a safe way. But also things like you could turn into like a mini Roomba, where if you drop it on the floor, you know, you don't know where your phone is, it won't just find your phone and say, here phone, it'll and get closer and closer.
They've got that camera app that lets you stand at one end,
yeah,
right?
That rotates 360 degrees. Yeah,
and it's like magical too. I would have when I saw it, I would have expected it just like vibrate, just like sort of turn around like randomly, like one of those old like football players, one of those like old tabletop football games. Mm-hmm. But it's like no, it's like turn 10 degrees, take the picture, turn 10 degrees. It's like that's spooky, man. And I want to see phones that have interesting, weird features like that. I would love it if that were something that Apple were to demonstrate at a keynote someday.
I've got it. What was that game when we were little kids that was like, it wasn't Rock'em Sock'em Robots, but it was around that time area where the little robots would kind of go like this and go zzz and bash each other?
It was before my time too, but it was like some sort of vibrating like metal plate. And so football players just sort of like, wherever they stopped. Yeah.
Now we can have our iPhones doing.
I have the feeling
I always thought that maybe there's an opportunity for a game developer, because like maybe this is the time for this has passed, because it would have worked better with like actual pocket pagers that have really powerful buzzers. But what if we have like a bar top football game where everybody puts their own personal pagers on the table, and by sending text messages, like by paging yourself, you can basically have the pass plays run and it would cost you like $1 per play. But AT&T would be very happy about it, and if you manage to get the peanut on top of your Motorola pager to the edge of the table before anybody else, there you go. You win a free beer.
Andy, you really got to come to Silicon Valley and launch a company.
Why is my genius wasted on the East Coast? Good heavens!
Yeah, I know.
It's the loss to society that I worry about, not any monetary gain that I might be missing out on.
Of course not, Andy. Of course not.
So I've always believed that Apple is going to get into haptics in big time. Ever since a few years ago, I saw a demo by Immersion. Immersion is a company that makes haptics technology. I think it's the leading company that does haptics. And in this demo, they had a tablet. It was at the time an ordinary tablet in terms of thickness and size and so on. And they had a pinball game on it. And they had as the ball rolled around, you just really felt the vibration of the ball rolling and the little bumpers going ding 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 and clanging and stuff like that, and you felt everything. It was just really shocking how much could be conveyed, how much sort of content and how believable it was, this pinball game, because of the haptics interface. And I thought, well, this is just a matter of time before this is going to happen. And now we're starting to see some really interesting things happening in haptics in the Apple Watch, which, you know, they're calling it the Taptics Engine. But essentially, according to, and maybe, Andy, you experience this yourself, there's an interface where if you tap on the watch, then it feels like somebody's tapping on your wrist, and it doesn't feel like something buzzing, buzzing, buzzing. It feels like somebody's tapping on your wrist. I mean, it feels almost directional. It feels very natural. And that's in the smartwatch. So you got to believe that the iPhone of the future, the iPhone 8 or something, is going to have some pretty sophisticated haptics that may have multiple haptics actuators in different parts of the phone. And that sort of, and this is, you know, wildly speculative, but that sort of thing could be enough to really turn a phone around or do other amazing magical things. But it certainly would be great for gaming, and in fact turn an iPhone into something more like an Xbox controller.
Apple is in a difficult situation in that they're the only makers of iPhones, and they can really only make two or three models. So if they decide to do something like as bizarre and weird and ultimately destined to fail, like the Fire Phone. Like, that would be one third of all the iPhones they manufacture would fail. But haptics are great. It's something that every time I test out like an Android phone, I really enjoy, because almost every Android phone uses haptics in the keyboard. And you might want to turn it on or turn it off or dial it in when you get your new phone. But believe me, if you're in a noisy environment and you're not really sure if you're making, quote, contact, unquote, with a certain button or a certain key press you're trying to make, the fact you get a reassurance that, yes, I do recognize that you did press this button, I'm telling you that you can now lift your finger off of this, it's just a nice little bit of reassurance. And things like when you boot up and it reassures you that, okay, I'm alive right now, everything worked out fine. It's just another way to have this hardware communicate with the user. And once you get above like baby-like just cries and growls and shrieks, and you elevate the haptics to communication, boy, what an opportunity that is. And the Apple Watch, I was only, like everybody else, I was only experiencing like a canned like demo that was just programmed to go through whatever motions it was programmed to go through. It didn't feel like it was amazingly subtle, like it was communicating anything other than it's buzzing, and it's buzzing in a different way now. But even that, just the ability to do nothing like since we're talking about watches and haptics, I installed like a new thing on my Moto 360 just 2 days ago that I forgot about until today, about an hour ago, when I went. I was cleaning upstairs, and I went downstairs to make lunch, and suddenly like my watch buzzes, and where's my watch buzzing, and it warns me that, hey, did you leave your phone behind somewhere, because I just lost contact with your phone, and that's the purpose of this thing. So if you leave your phone like in a bar or in a sofa cushion or whatever, it will, as soon as it loses contact, so as soon as you're about 10 or 15 feet away from it, it will say, hey, by the way, I don't know if there's something going on here, but maybe you want to know about that. It's such a cool thing to put, particularly on a watch that's designed to alert you to something that you need to know about right away, as opposed to, okay, I guess this buzzing in my pocket means that I might have gotten a Gmail or email from any one of 400 different people. I'm not going to even bother with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the Apple Watch, there's been some new reports coming out that have been kind of shocking some people, because I think a lot of people are kind of on the fence about whether the Apple Watch is going to have any sort of market success at all. And now there are different reports. One of them is from UBS's Steve Milinovich, who says that 1 out of 10 iPhone owners are very likely to buy an Apple Watch when it comes out, I think within the first year or something like that. And that adds up to millions, dozens of millions of Apple Watches being sold in the first year. Serenity, let's start with you. Do you buy this? Do you think just based on your gut feeling and what you know about the Apple fan base, do you think that people are going to be gobbling up these expensive and probably unnecessary peripherals?
Yeah, I don't even necessarily know if they're unnecessary, perhaps, in that now that WatchKit is available for developers, we have some idea of what the first 6 to 8 months of the watch is going to look like. And for people who want more subtle notifications, for people who want basically a way to connect with their phone without necessarily having to have it in front of their face at all times, the Apple Watch actually seems like a really useful piece of technology. And the possibilities for it, including the haptics engine and everything else, as we discussed, I think are actually boundless. Especially WatchKit, is fairly limited in terms of what developers would be able to do. It basically acts as an extension for your current iPhone apps. But once full-fledged watch apps are able to be developed, which, we're hearing rumors of that later in 2015, maybe WWDC area. I really do think that there's a market for the Apple Watch, and I'm not at all surprised. I mean, it's not, this survey does not say 1 in 10 owners very likely to buy an Apple Watch edition, like a specialty $5,000 Apple Watch. These are people, the majority of these people are probably looking at the $349 base model Apple, probably the Apple Sport, right? And for a lot of people, I think the Apple Sport will be more than enough for people's needs. And I don't know. I feel very positive about the Apple Watch. I got a chance to play with it in the hands-on demo area when they premiered it back a few months ago. And even with the completely canned demonstration, it's a very beautiful piece of technology. It's the first watch base, you know, watch style mobile computing that I've ever considered getting. And I, you know, I played with the Pebble and I've played with the Moto, you know, and I've played with a bunch of these and none of them actually sort of sparked for me the way that the Apple Watch has.
Yeah, Allison, you know, I remember when the iPhone first was announced and then shipped in 2007, January and then summer, I think, respectively. And at the time, I was a naysayer. And it's hilarious. Now, my main beef against the iPhone was that it was too big because I had a BlackBerry Pearl. And it was like about the size of a box of Chiclets. It was tiny. And I thought, you know, it's a big screen and stuff, but who cares? It's boring. And then sometime after that, what was it, a year later or less than a year later, they came out with the App Store and all the apps. And I started seeing what the apps could do. And I think like millions of people, I started to sort of my whole view of what the iPhone was completely transformed because of the apps. And I think that's what Serenity is saying here. That once the developers get their hands on, you know, the kit that came out recently and build some apps and you see what is actually what this thing is actually going to be used for, it's going to really spark people to get excited about it, talk about it, share the information. It'll be viral. Do you buy that argument or do you think it's going to land with a thud?
Well, you actually said almost exactly what I was thinking. When they talk about what the Apple Watch is, I think that we aren't going to know what it is until the developers tell us what it is. Now, unfortunately, they're going along the same path where they're saying that these first apps that come out have to just be tied to an iPhone app. And I understand the reasons behind that, but I don't think we're going to really know what it is until the apps are completely opened up. I mean, like you said, with the phone, we thought it was a phone. But when's the last time you made a phone call with it? You know, almost everything we do with our iPhones, and especially with the iPad is perfect example of an unnecessary thing, right? Nobody needed it. We didn't need it. I didn't need it. Why was I going to need that? Now I can't live without it. So, but it was the developers, not necessarily Apple, who showed me why I needed it and taught me what it was supposed to do. So I'm not maybe quite as bullish as Serenity is on it. I feel pretty good, though, that when the developers show us what it can be, that's when we're going to go, oh, it's not a watch.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think another component is going to be, I think it will be a lot like the launch of the iPhone, where we forget that it sold maybe 10 million in its first, it really didn't start becoming a phenomenon until about a year after it. And I think that's not just because the App Store came about and it was refined and they were able to improve some of its original limitations, but also because there were now about 5 million people with iPhones that could, everybody knew someone or knew someone who knew someone who had an iPhone who could explain, gee, why would I want a phone that doesn't have any buttons on it? And I think that smartwatches are pretty much the same thing. I wind up inadvertently evangelizing wearables wherever I go, because when someone sees like my blank watch and suddenly it lights up and here's a picture of a squirrel with a time on it, they say, is that one of those smartwatches? How do you like it? And then I will say, well, I love it a lot, and here's how I use it, and here's what I thought was going to be that wasn't going to work, but boy, does it work great. And every time I travel, I do this, and look what it just told me right now. And then that leaves them thinking that, gee, it's a difficult thing to understand in the abstract, especially given that there has never been a product like this before. But once you wind up working with somebody who has one, it goes from a cursory 5 or 10 minute demo to a month later casually asking, hey, do you still like that, to 4 months or a year later, you're really now about 10 cents away from actually wanting to actually buy it. And now, okay, Steve, you're gonna have to tell me, what don't you like about it? What do you ever have any regrets? I think it really is wearing people down over the first year. And part of that is going to be, as Allison said, once developers are able to populate it and really emphatically show you what it does besides encouraging you to move around and how it will enhance your life.
Yeah, and I think one of the unanswered questions is with the pricing. You see reports that the gold version, the edition version, is going to be $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 somewhere in there. That's a lot of money. And then the watch
is kind of a lot. I'm worried about that.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That's where it starts, and that's not even with sapphire. That's with aluminum and so on. But at the very high end, the gold edition, and the watch nerds would chime in and say, "Oh, that's nothing. People pay a lot more than that for gold watches. They pay $10,000, $20,000 for gold watch." Yes, but the problem is that they buy a watch at those prices because they're going to hand it down to their great-grandkids on their deathbed. Take my watch, you know, it's like that kind of thing. Whereas the Apple Watch is going to be obsolete in
your
a year and a half.
Your father smuggled this out of Vietnam. Yeah.
That's right, exactly.
So we were talking about, over at iMore, we were talking about ways for this not to be so much of a problem, which is to say, like, if you're paying $5,000 for an Apple Watch, how might the majority of those components stay in your hands, especially if you're going to do things like engraving, for instance, on a $10,000, $5,000 watch. And one of the major thoughts was something where the internal chip is actually replaceable, whereas, you know, that the screen is going to be retina quality for that size, for the 42 and 38, I want to say, millimeter screens of the watches. So, you know, the screen's maybe not going to need to get so much better for a couple of years yet, unless you really want to cram a 4K display into a 300 pixel device.
Lawrence of Arabia on your wrist.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Oh man, those sand dunes look amazing. No, I mean, to be perfectly honest, if Apple figures out a way to just basically like, oh yeah, we take it to an Apple store, we take off the back panel, and for $100, we'll replace your, you know, A8X mobile chip with a A10. And then all of a sudden you have all of the new fancy things and you still have the majority of your $5,000 beautiful watch chain and beautiful watch body and personally engraved message about your, you know, your family crest or something like that. Which is, you know, keeping in line with traditional watchmaking as well. When you think about, you know, how watches are repaired, they're not, you know, it's not just throw away the entire thing, get a new watch. If you have a really nice watch, you go to a watch repair shop and they, you know, they take it apart and they put in little batteries and they, you know, tweak with it. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like that's a potential
serenity. Option. That sounds really fun, Serenity. But do you think that sounds like Apple to do that, to not encourage us just to buy another one?
I mean, I think the problem is Apple has never really sold a $10,000 machine unless you count like a souped up Mac Pro.
20th anniversary.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, it's a very different market that they're getting into. And they've already acknowledged some, you know, they've acknowledged that they know they're getting into a different market by the way that they've been courting the fashion industry and by, you know, taking on fashion industry advisors. I don't know if that's actually how it works, but I feel like it might be a good way, you know, it may be one of the things where...
Either she's having something that I'd like to have, or Skype is freaking
slowing
out again.
Her down.
Sorry about that, Serenity. I think Skype is not your friend today.
I think a point she made was, I just got what she was saying, was that maybe the addition, you can do that, but the sport, you wouldn't be able to swap it out. You wouldn't be able to swap out the components. That might be, now I see where you're going with it. Yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in just a second, we're going to come back and talk about two areas, actually, where Apple is getting its butt handed to them by Google, maybe. We'll talk about it and figure out what is going on exactly. But first, I want to tell you about NatureBox, one of our sponsors today. NatureBox is a fantastic product for health and for better living because they're delicious snacks. We all like to snack. And I think one of the reasons we like to snack is that, you know, when we're relaxing, when we're at home, just, you know, watching TV or around the house doing whatever, we don't really feel like going through a big chore of making a healthy meal, going through all that kind of stuff. We just want to grab something that's, you know, that's maybe a little sweet, a little salty or whatever, that's delicious, and just eat it between meals. We all like to do it. We're all going to do it. Let's face it. And oftentimes most snacks are just not good for you. They have trans fats. They have way too much salt, way too much sugar. They have unhealthy ingredients, and they're really nothing good for you. And that's why NatureBox is so fantastic, because it's super, super easy for you to go ahead and do what you're going to do anyway, except you have healthy food. Like, here's an example, Lone Star Snack Mix. These are delicious, with a flavor the size of Texas. These are really amazing. And one of the fun things about NatureBox, by the way, before I get into what's innovative about this company, is the fact that their flavors are always so shocking. So they have blueberry nom noms, all kinds of really innovative flavors. And sometimes when you hear it, you're like, wait, I've never really heard that flavor combination ever. How could that possibly be good? And then you try it and it's absolutely fantastic. But here's the innovative part about NatureBox. Basically, what you do is you can just get a complimentary trial box. You just pay $2 for shipping and they will send you a trial box to your house or to your place of work if you want to have it come to work. And you just try the various things that they send you. And then you go to the website, and if you decide to sign up and subscribe to subscription snack service, essentially, you can go in there and say, you know what, I really like these two, but I didn't like this one. And they'll send you those two again in the future, and then they'll send you another one to surprise you in the future. And they have so many different flavors and different styles and so on. They have apple pie, oat clusters, sea salt, cracked pepper, pumpkin seeds, all kinds of things. Many of these are dried fruits or nuts. Many of them are granola type things. There's just so many different types of snacks that you can get. They're fantastic, and they got zero artificial flavors, zero artificial colors, no artificial sweeteners, 0 grams of trans fats, no high fructose corn syrup, and you can even find snacks with no added sugar and without gluten, gluten-free snacks if you like. You can choose your dietary preferences, whether you're vegan or whatever it is, and you just go in there to the website. It's a modern service, so you can go in there and optimize and customize exactly what you want to get. And then, you know, they send you stuff, and you, over time, I guarantee you, as we have right here in Twit in the break room, you'll discover your favorites, and you're really going to be thrilled because they have snacks you've never, ever even heard of. So I passed some of these out to the studio audience here. What do you think? What do you think of Nature Box? They're good. Yeah? Very good. Okay, so the reviews are coming in. Thumbs up all the way around.
I'm hungry here too, Mike. I'm What's hungry that? Over here. I would really like some of that Nature Box.
We'll fax you some right now. Yeah. Some of the flatter snacks. Well, start your free trial today. Start your trial today and get a complimentary sampler box at naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong, start snacking smarter. Go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank Nature Box for their support of Mac Break Weekly. And I thank Nature Box for your delicious snacks. I eat them all the time. And I really appreciate the fact that they are healthy. Well, you know, Apple has a former hobby. Now they're very serious about Apple TV. And this is an area like the the iPad area where Google is kind of encroaching on the territory with lower cost alternatives that are, in many cases, found to be maybe superior by a lot of consumers. So let's start with Apple TV. The market researcher Parks Associates is reporting that Apple is losing ground to Chromecast and also Roku in the first three quarters of 2014. The Chromecast, of course, is a very cheap, $35 or something like that. It's a little dongle that plugs in your TV and just lets you stream stuff from your device. Very easy to use, very friendly. It's a great stocking stuffer, as I think Leo said on Twit over the weekend. It's a very compelling offering, whereas Apple TV is kind of feeling kind of old and busted these days. They're really not updating it like people expected them to. So let's talk about this. Andy Anako, is this an important business or isn't it for Apple? And what are they going to do to sort of prevent everybody else, from the Googles to the Rokus to the Amazons, from stealing this out from under them?
I really have to conclude that Apple is planning not an improvement on Apple TV, but a reinvention of it. You know, where they didn't just simply, we put in a better processor and, hey, look at the new graphical user interface and, hey, look at the new channels we have. I have to believe that there's going to be a keynote level event in which they talk about the new role that Apple TV is there to fulfill inside the house. Maybe even going beyond just simply streaming entertainment, but also by being a fixed location, the ability to know that, okay, this now the user of this iPhone is now in the living room, and therefore I'm gonna allow this person not to have to even use Touch ID at all to open up and unlock their phone, because I'm gonna trust the fact that this phone is in front of this Apple TV. I'm gonna let people send files to each other based on proximity, that sort of stuff, and that's just one example of stuff. And the reason why I have so much faith in that is because Apple has let this thing lie fallow for so many quarters. And at this point, there is no question about it. It is the worst major streaming media box you can buy. I mean, it is barely okay. I have on my TV over there in the living room, I've got, no joke, I've got the Fire TV, I've got a Chromecast, and I've got a Roku 3 and an Apple TV. And the times when I switch it over to that HDMI port to use the Apple TV, it is actively painful. The user interface is really so 25-inch Sony Trinitron tube TV grade. after like days and days of getting so much of my entertainment through Roku, I switch over to Apple TV and say, what is that thing? I don't recognize. Oh, that's a wait cursor. I have never, in 3 days of using the Roku, I have never had to say, hey, you have to wait because I have to load stuff in. The fact that there's so many open apps for the Roku that I've got the Plex media server that connects to anything inside my house. I've got a media player that if I just simply take any USB stick and just like put it right there into the Roku, it will play any file, any picture, any movie that's on there. There's just no reason for me to recommend that to the Apple TV to anybody. And because Apple is usually very, very smart about once they give up on something, they don't just simply let it sort of peter out. They just simply say, okay, this is kind of canceled because we don't have any legal reason to do this. We don't have any profit reason to do this. Okay, maybe the iPods are kind of contrary to what I'm talking about. But there's so much opportunity, given how much business they do in streaming media, given how much business they want to do in controlling things inside your home, such a big opportunity for Apple TV. I cannot but believe that sometime in 2015, there's going to be a huge event in which everybody's suddenly going to want to have an Apple TV again, because God knows no one wants one right now.
But Andy, it has that amazing game where you have to type words by moving the cursor around. I love a challenge.
My favorite is the hide and seek game where, okay, tiny little remote control that's only this thick. Where are you? 3, 2, 1, I'm coming. Maybe it works with the Apple Watch. I noticed that you need 1,000 more steps to reach 10,000. So I'm going to let you have to not just find the one Apple remote. I'm going to have you find one out of three that's inside. Oh, anyway.
It's part of Health Kit.
It's just no good. It's no fun.
Serenity, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying I have to agree with Andy 100%, especially you're getting hints. The Apple TV has not been refreshed since January of 2013. So that's almost 2 full years with, with nothing going on, which says to me, and despite all of that, Tim Cook repeatedly goes, we're still interested in this. This is definitely more than a hobby. We have lots of interest in Apple TV, and you're seeing that despite the fact that it hasn't been updated in nearly 2 years, hardware style, the software improvements has actually been getting it to gain market share. Now, granted, you do have the Chromecast and the Fire TV coming in and impinging upon that because they're better deals at half the price. I mean, that makes sense. If you want, the only reason to buy an Apple TV right now is if you want iTunes content on your television and the AirPlay, the AirPlay support, which again, Chromecast and being able to send web pages and stuff like that, that's almost as good. But the fact that Tim Cook constantly reiterates, we are interested in this.
Two years is nothing. And look at how long we've been expecting the Apple Watch, the watch formerly known as the iWatch. I mean, it's just every single announcement, we're like, well, this is going to be it. And then nothing. Watch. And then when they finally announced it, it was a big initiative that obviously sucked in tons of resources, and they put a lot of thought and money into it. And so, yeah, it's got to be something like that happening on the Apple TV front. But Allison, I want to ask you about home automation. Do you think that the Apple TV or a TV box is the right place to have a hub for home automation, serving up a HomeKit type stuff through Apple's system? Or is that just not a good way to do it?
I don't know that that's really a good way to do it, because there's a lot of people who don't have televisions these days, right? These kids today, with their crazy internet stuff. So I don't know that that's the right place for that. But I did want to say, I mean, I would think that's a lot more logical to have on your mobile device, because if you're upstairs, you don't want to have to go downstairs to the Apple TV to go unlock the door. That kind of thing doesn't really make much sense to me. But I did want to say, like Andy, I've got one of everything. My Fire TV stick comes December 18th. And what I'm finding is that I use the Apple TV a lot, but I don't like it. So just like Andy's saying, so many of those things drive me nuts. My single favorite thing, I mean, I would buy a Roku over an Apple TV for one single thing alone, and that's the 30-second back. And I've noticed that one of the things it does on, I don't know if it's in all applications, but I'm pretty sure I saw it in Netflix, or it might have been Amazon Prime. When I did 30-second back, it automatically turned on subtitles. Because why do you back up? Because you didn't hear what they said.
Yeah.
Not because you didn't see, usually. It's because of what you heard. And so I use the Roku all the time for Amazon and for Netflix, but I use iTunes to rent movies, and I use AirPlay all the time. Every time I go to use the Chromecast, I sit there for about a minute and a half going, where's my Chromecast remote? Oh wait, there isn't one. That's right.
It's my phone.
Every single time. I mean, I've never turned it on and gone, oh yeah, grab my phone and go do what I got to do. So I still think the Apple TV has a place, and it's amazing that it does have a place considering how awful it is in so many ways. I did run into an interesting problem where for about 3 months straight, every time I went to play a movie, it would come up and say, okay, you can play it in 7 hours or 9 hours or 6 hours. And it would change. It wouldn't be the kind of thing where it said that and then immediately started to play. It would literally take hours. And so I got in the habit of rent the movie, tell Apple to give me my money back. Rent the movie, tell Apple to give me my money back. And I'd flip over to Amazon and the Roku and rent it over there. And finally, I got this crazy idea. I called up Apple. You know, it's weird to think of actually asking for tech support, but I called them up and they told me this double secret remote control thing you can do to reset the Apple TV, which is different than the reset that's on screen. And it's different than a full factory reset. And it's different from unplugging it. It's actually, I forget what it is, like hold down the down arrow and the home button at the same time for 5 seconds. And the woman said, we don't know why this fixes it, but it seems to fix it for almost everybody. And ever since then, it's been perfect. I never get that weird waiting delay anymore.
Wow.
Yeah,
that is amazing.
I've had those same sort of bad experiences. I actually had to. I'm not averse to giving George Takei more money because I think I should give George Takei as much money as I can afford to give him. But I wound up having to rent like his documentary twice because I rented it on. I made the rental on my laptop, figuring that I bet that of course as soon as I go into Apple TV I'll be able to simply play it from there. But no dice. But I am able to rent a second copy from the device itself. I'm like. Really? It's like, I did have $8 worth of desire to see this movie that very night. So I did rent it again. And I knew I had a blood donation come up so I could, you know, go see the other copy. But it's like, it is such a non-Apple product in that it really is a very ordinary product. Again, you have the exact same expectations you have with anything you spend $100 for at Best Buy, which is some parts of it are going to be fine. Most of it is going to be okay. And lots of it are going to be, okay, well, they didn't think about that at all. And what an odd thing to think about, anything with an Apple logo on it.
With a horrible remote. It's horrible.
Oh, God. Well, there is a way that you can actually, there's actually a menu inside the settings so that you can actually teach it your whatever remote that you're using like with your cable box so that you don't have to. Before I found out about that, no joke, I actually had the little stick of gum remote taped to the back of my usual remote because it was the only way. It was like the men's room key at a gas station. It was the only way not to lose it.
So, Andy, my trick has always just been setting it up on my phone and completely just getting rid of the tiny remote. Just being like, nope, sorry, it's gone.
Yeah. So you know, I'll put you in. You have to enter your password. Get it on the network, and then you got to go back to the remote. And of course, it's long and complex and annoying as all get out.
But at that point, you hide the remote so that you know where it is. You're like, okay, you're going in the top drawer of my media center, buddy, and then I'll find you if I ever need a reset. But otherwise, you don't get lost in the couch cushions.
That might be the last final frontier for certain generations where I know I can have a remote app on my phone. I also have the remote app for my cable box, like on all my phones. But there is something about that's one of the things I love about the Roku is that you have this big, thick remote with big, fat buttons. Because when I'm sitting on the sofa, my mind is not in operating a multi-touch interface application sort of mode. It is see where my thumb is. That is the button that starts the entertainment and pauses the entertainment. And if I want to like, if I want to like stop watching this entertainment and pick out another entertainment, I simply move my thumb up and like this. When I feel a button underneath, I press that. As opposed to now, let's see. Now, okay, so this swipe. There we go. And now I want to be able to do things by feel, which is why another reason why I think that the Roku is so well thought out. It's a big TV watcher's remote as opposed to we figured a different way of processing aluminum and bonding it to electronics to make the lowest profile remote that's ever been made. We think it's the greatest remote you can buy today.
Can you please?
Yeah, I know where your remote is.
They're not even in my sofa.
I know where your remote is, Andy, because my daughter lost her Apple TV remote and we suspected that maybe she got it stuck in her cross-stitch bag and it fell out at my house. So I looked around and I found I had two. So I gave it back to her, but then she found hers. So we're up one right now.
They're like socks.
Well, I think we can all agree that the Apple TV is the least Apple-esque product that Apple makes. So let's talk about the most Apple-esque product that Apple makes, which is the iPad, which is getting trounced in the education market by the Chromebook, by Google's Chromebook, according to IDC. IDC says that that for the first time ever, Google has overtaken Apple in American schools. They say that Google shipped 715,000 Chromebooks to schools in the third quarter, while Apple shipped only 702,000 iPads to schools. And Chromebooks now, as a whole, account for a quarter of the educational market overall. This sort of is in line with my own thinking about what's best for education. I happen to think that the Chromebook is a fantastic device for the schools, and the iPad not so much, in part because it's so expensive. What do you think about that, Andy?
I agree completely. Because it's these things are dead simple. They're dead cheap. I recommend them all the time to lots and lots of people. Just over Thanksgiving, someone was asking me, Jim, think about buying a notebook for this person, and I've got a budget of X dollars, and they had $500 to spend. What they thought was going to be, obviously the best thing is going to be to buy a cheap Windows notebook. And I said, I gave them, well, here are one or two ideas that are good at that price point, but think about $200 for an Acer Chromebook and then give them an iPad as well. They might even like that combination, might get more use out of it. And the other things that we're talking, so yeah, if you're selling something that costs $200 and they're high quality things, they're not junk. The keyboards are it's going to sound like I'm trying to be snide here, but I absolutely tell you that the keyboard on a $200 Acer Chromebook is as good as the keyboard on my MacBook Pro that I bought just last year, because the keyboard on the MacBook Pro is not very good. They're so much cheaper, but also they remove the problem. Since they don't run really anything, they're really easy to administrate. It's hard for someone to get in trouble using one of those. And also, they don't have the stealability of an iPad. And you don't feel like you're putting kids' lives in danger by broadcasting the entire world that there are 300 children that are much smaller and can't run as fast as you that are carrying around a $500 thing in their backpacks. So, yeah, I mean, it's if Apple made a better statement about how their software is going to be much, much better at what schools need than a Chromebook, maybe they would not be doing quite so poorly, but they have not made that case. When's the last time they even talked about iBooks Author, about making even high school textbooks available on iPad? So I think that maybe this is another thing where Apple is interested, but maybe they're not. They didn't see that quick vein of gold, and they don't like the numbers that are coming in, and they're just going to wait and see how well this can do in the future. I don't know.
Absolutely.
They're just juggling too much.
Yeah.
You know, they're just trying to juggle too much. iBooks Author is a great piece of software that's now a year out of date. And granted, they'd made some really, really wonderful under the hood improvements when Yosemite came out. But overall, like, Apple basically said, hey, we're really interested in education. We've always been really interested in education. Now put that on pause while we work on the Apple Watch and the Apple TV and the new iPhone and the new, we'll get back to you eventually, right?
Yeah.
And no, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the administrative costs just by itself is what this really should be. If I were in administering a group of machines for a school, I'd be hard-pressed to not go with Chromebooks. We've talked before about how Apple had the great deal with the LA School District on the iPads, and it fell through because the minute the students got them, they just figured out how to get around all the restrictions. And personally, I would have taken that group of students and said, okay, we're going to put you in computer science class right now and encourage that behavior instead of punishing them. But when you think about dealing with administrative costs, in fact, that's one of the reasons we've always pushed Macs over PCs. Even when PCs were cheaper, you just spent so much less time screwing around with the updates and all that kind of stuff on the Mac side, and viruses and all that nonsense. Now you've got the Chromebook that's a really tough sell, because you don't have to hardly administer those at all. And so if you've got reasonably good hardware, I think that's a great point. Another person, I lost it here in the live chat room. Somebody pointed out, does anybody steal Chromebooks?
It's never happened. Ever in the history of mankind, except a Chromebook Pixel. I might even steal a Chromebook Pixel, but the regular ones, no. Sure. Ever happen.
So that might be a consideration.
They're like
too.
Stealing paper napkins at McDonald's.
Yeah.
Like, okay, maybe you can, but why would you? And why would you admit it?
And who would report it?
Well, the resale value, right? The resale value is not great.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have picks galore. We're all going to have picks. Allison, you're going to have a pick of the week for us as well?
I will pull something out.
Okay, great.
See what I can do.
You work on that. I will work on the break. I want to tell you about personal capital. You know, Andy was showing off and waving around his fancy Moto 360 watch. Personal Capital is a service that will help you get your financial life in order. They were one of the very first apps on Android Wear. That's right. I think it was a week into Android Wear, and I was getting a buzzing feeling on my wrist wearing my, I think it was an LG G watch at the time. And it was telling me that I had that I was about to incur a $35 fee from my bank. And this is an alert that I didn't see on my phone. I didn't see it on my desktop. I didn't go to the website. I felt it on my wrist. I looked down. I took action, and I saved myself $35. Wham! Personal Capital is free, and I already saved $35. This is what a fantastic service this is. The basic way that you use Personal Capital, usually you're not going to use it mainly through the watch. You're mostly going to use it online. What they do is you plug in all your different financial accounts, your bank accounts, your investments, your 401k, all that kind of stuff. And then it brings all that information and shows you in charts and graphs in an intuitive, easy to understand way what the heck is happening with your money. And when you can see that sort of 10,000 foot view of what's happening with your money, you can make better decisions. It'll alert you and prevent you from wasting money on unnecessary fees and fines. It's just a fantastic way to get your financial life in order. And I think most of us just have vague ideas about what's happening with our money, and it's not good enough. You have to have specific, clear understanding of where it's going, what's happening, where the danger spots are, how you can make changes and adjustments so that you lose less money and make more money, save more money, and basically get control of your money, because eventually you're going to want to have as much money as you possibly can. You don't want to waste it on unnecessary stuff that goes on within the financial services world. So just take a minute. It pays big dividends. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency. And again, the thing is that you can make better decisions, better investment decisions, better decisions about the fees you're paying, better decisions about how much to spend, just all across the board, better decisions. And that's the right way to get your financial house in order. To set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/MacBreak. Personal Capital is free, and it's a smart way to grow your money. And we thank Personal Capital for their support of MacBreak Weekly. Andy Anatko, do you have a pick of the week?
Yes, I do. Let's see if I can get Cramcam 3000, the future video podcasting, set up for you. I've been talking a lot about like really good like folding pocket keyboards, because ever since the iPhone 6 Plus came out, that's really nice big screen. You kind of want to be able to blast through emails or even just like actual write full things with it. And one of my picks a few weeks ago was one of my first nice discoveries, which was the iWorks keyboard, WERKZ, which folds out nicely. It has this big, big kind of ugly gap, but I found that you can actually sort of make your way. You get used to it after your first like 100 words or whatever with it. And it has this nice little case that doubles as a phone stand. But I since then have found something that's even better, even though it's about twice as much. This is the Flyshark folding keyboard. It is almost twice as much, which is sounds okay. It sounds bad until you realize that this costs $30. This is also a folding Bluetooth keyboard, and it sells on Amazon for $50. And what the reason why I like it so much, already too much clutter on this desk, sorry about this, is that you flip it open, and here's what you get. And what I'm calling your attention to is that what you don't get is that really big gap between these two halves of the folding keyboard. You also get a space bar that is, you can basically put your thumbs wherever you want. I also like the fact that, like the iWorks, it also has mechanical switches on the side so that the battery will not run down until you actually tell it, until you actually turn it on, turn it off. The battery won't run down inside your bag. And it's very, very comfortable to type with. The only disadvantage of it is that the numbers, as you can see, are accessible by a function key. So whereas the $30 one actually has its own little row of numbers here. This one, you actually, to get numbers, you have to hold on a function key in order to get that working. But All in all, I actually find it a lot faster to type on this than on this because I don't know if you can actually see this, but there is actually some of these keys actually overlap over the hinge. Like look at the H key right there. So as a result, when it's lying flat like that, you get something that's almost identical to the feel of a real keyboard. And it is almost the same size and layout, if I can do this without spilling all over the place, almost the exact same size as my MacBook Pro keyboard here. Pardon the crumbs and the mess. It's been a long, long holiday. And so I think that this is the one that I'm going to wind up with as my final recommendation. It's not perfect, but no pocketable, foldable keyboard is going to be as good as like an Apple wireless keyboard. And it does get me right to the solution that I want to get to, which is the ability to simply travel for the day with just this inside my pocket. And realize this is the iPhone 6 Plus. You put even an iPhone 6, it really takes up no extra space in your pocket. And I feel as though if I have that extra unexpected hour and a half, 2 hours, if I miss my train, I can actually set up on a table and I feel as though I can get an hour's worth of actual typing and actual work done with it. So it's $50. The only, a lot of people might require a recommendation from somebody on before they would trust this. Come on, Crane Cam 3000. Because the only place I can find to buy it is Amazon, and it has that sort of imported from China and it might or might not work marketing lingo where it is best, freshest, blue, tooth key type 4, great with iPhone, iPad, Nexus phone. But trust me, it really is the works. It started off as a Kickstarter, as a matter of fact, which is how my attention got called to it. But now it's an actual shipping product. And for $50, I mean, the only keyboard I've found that's better is this one from Lapworks, which folds out twice. It's based on the old handspring keyboard that folds in and folds in like that. It's very, very good. But the problem is that the only really trustworthy place to get it, I mean, it's good enough that I would actually recommend it, is Lapworks, and they charge $140 for it. So for $140, you really have to be certain that you're going to get a lot of use out of this. For $50, it makes a good present. It makes a good, I may as well just buy this just in case and put it inside your handbag and just keep it in there.
What's the name of the new one, Andy? Excuse me? The one that you are recommending, what is the name of it one more time?
It's called the Fly Shark. The company is Fly Shark. They call it the iLepo. I don't know why they call it iLepo. It's the seventh Marx Brothers, I know. And if you look for either of those two names, you will only find references to the Kickstarter. You will not find a store page or a product page. The only place I can find that actually has it is Amazon. The only other thing that I could say that be prepared about it is that, like a lot of these other folding keyboards, it really works. It's a lot more stable if you have your screen cleaning cloth or a handkerchief and you put that underneath it, because otherwise the bottom, these are supposed to be like rubberized, like anti-skid things, but they're not quite grabby enough. So it's possible when you're typing for it to sort of slide around a little bit. But if you put like any sort of a...
Does it work on a lap?
Okay. Your lap is daintier than mine. It's not lappable by any means. You do need to have like on top of a hard stable surface in order to make it work. But if you put it on top of any sort of cloth, I find that stops it from skidding around. That's the only hassle. And you know, it's wintertime. You should have a handkerchief with you anyway. So that's not a bad thing.
Wonderful. The Fly Shark iLepo. I guess the brand name iLeper was taken. So they went with iLepo. What are you going to do? Serenity Caldwell, what do you have for us?
All right. My pick of the week is an app, and I blame Jason Snell entirely for this. Over Thanksgiving, he was
talking
about...
It's usually safe to do so.
It's true. It's true. I blame him for a lot of things in my life. He was talking about, you know, an app that had captivated him during the Thanksgiving weekend called Crossy Road, which is very similar
I know
to...
It's
it's like Flappy Bird meets Frogger is how I've heard it described. It's very well designed. The sort of 3D blocky graphics are really delightful. It is an infuriating game, an absolutely infuriatingly delightful game that I played way too much of this Thanksgiving when I had Floridian sun to sit out. Instead, I was like inside trying to beat this silly game.
Which you can't beat it because, of course, it's a never-ending series of cars and trains and leapfrogs that you have to dance around. And although it does have some little in-app purchase gimmicks that are kind of silly, I just really enjoyed playing this. I had a seven-year-old hanging out who saw me playing it. It was like, ooh, it's the chicken game. Can I play the chicken game? Oh, you shouldn't press on that. That's bad. Oh, if you do, like, he got so into it with me. So it was a really good way to bond over vacation with a seven-year-old and a way to escape actually going outdoors. I thought it was a lot of fun. I definitely recommend everybody play it. It's just silly. It's silly. It's a good time. And it's really, like, it's more addicting than you think about, you know, hanging out and just... Who's playing that right now, or is it just a video? Because I'm now slightly captivated watching this.
Just a video.
I love YouTube. These games. Even if they were just a screensaver, I would spend $5 just to have that as a screensaver. It's a really beautiful piece of art.
It really is.
Yeah, very, very cool. All right, well, that looks fun. That looks really fun. I want to try that. Allison, what do you have for us?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have a Chromecast 3000, the future of video podcasting, but I will try to show off. I'm going to go very old school here. I'm going to show off a book. George from Tulsa, one of the listeners of my show, sent me this for my 500th episode. It's called Iconic. It's a photographic tribute to Apple innovation. It's a giant hardcover coffee table book, and it is just beautiful. It's got an introduction by Jim Dalrymple and one by Steve Wozniak. And it doesn't do what you would think it would do. It doesn't go chronologically through everything Apple ever did. Instead, it's got sections for things like peripherals. And so it's got a lot of the cool old school stuff. Let's see. I bookmarked a couple of pages that look kind of cool in here. And they're just beautiful photographs and little tiny short explanations of what they're showing you and when things were introduced. The very last page of it has a picture. Let's see, I got to bring this up here. Is kind of poignant. It's got a picture of Steve Jobs' glasses at the... Oh, that's bright on that camera. But anyway, you can believe me, it's his glasses. It is beautiful. It's thick. It's heavy. It's just yummy coffee table-ness for that sort of thing. It runs $62 on Amazon right now. And again, it's called Iconic. And I probably should have remembered who did it. But it's just beautiful. I'm really, really digging this. I just got it a couple hours. Jonathan Zuffi is the guy's name.
Cool.
Just wonderful. Yeah.
That looks very, very cool. Can't wait to see that. Well, my pick of the week is an application called Typed. Hope you guys didn't cover this on a previous show. It's called Typed, and basically it's a word processor. It's a minimalist word processor. We've all seen them, the kind of thing where you want to type, you just want to write, and it takes over the screen and blocks out all the sort of clutter and that sort of thing. The problem with most of those types of word processors is that they're too minimalist. They clear out the distractions, but they also clear out the tools that you need, and they also don't produce the kinds of documents you want. One of the great things about Typed is that it's a markdown editor, so you can it'll generate web-friendly HTML versions of your documents if you want them, which is really useful. I think most of us write for the web. I certainly do, and if you're going to do anything that's going to have any markup in it, it's nice if that is automated. You don't have to sit there and type that out. It also has a Zen mode, which will basically get rid of all the controls and play like new agey kind of music in the background, sort of ambient music. That's a little cheesy. They have another thing called responsive layout, which basically it'll resize itself automatically to whatever size you want to use it in. Now, the good news is that it's a really great functional word processing document that helps you write because it clears your mind and helps you focus on your words instead of the tools, instead of the environment. And that's, you know, again, the good news. The bad news is available only for the Mac, and it costs $19.99. They don't have a freemium model. They don't have a free version, which I think is a mistake. They should have one so you can try it out. People are very particular about their writing tools, and $20 isn't that's real money. And so it'd be nice to have a free version you could try for a trial period or upgrade for more features or whatever. But no, you have to pay the money in order to try it. But having said that, it's a very, very nice editor. And it's just a fantastic way to write. And I know that those of you who write, you know that the biggest barrier, I think, for most of us in writing is the fact that there are distractions everywhere. And so,
have you seen Focusrite, Mike? I think it's open source, but it's Windows and Mac and Linux, I think. It's on all three. It's at least on two of the three of those. And it has sort of the same kind of thing with the themes and really definitely does help you focus. But I'm always just flipping away from it anyway because I want to go do something else.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of that genre. Sometimes I just want to – and that's one of the reasons why I often use my iPad for writing because it's more clutter-free. But if you got to use a MacBook Pro with Retina – this is the way to get that iPad experience of minimalism and, you know, nothing else going on so you can focus and concentrate. Well, that is, ladies and gentlemen, Mac Break Weekly. I want to thank you, Andy Anatko, Serenity Caldwell, Allison Sheridan, and thank you, Jason Howell. Thanks to all of you, viewers and listeners, the Mac Break Weekly audience, the hordes of ravenous Apple fans out there who watch this show every single week, and I'm one of you. I enjoy this show, and it's nice to be able to talk back to these people for a change rather than just listening. So this has been a thrill for me, and I appreciate Leo. Leo's kite surfing or something today. So it was great to be able to step in and take his place for one day at least. Andy Anatko, Chicago Sun-Times technology columnist, thank you so much for joining us. And what's been going on? What are you looking forward to this month and over the holidays?
Basically, a lot of deep soak reviews are coming out in the next few weeks, starting with finally my iPad Air 2 review. As usual, it's the Ken Burns effect applied to a review, which is let's have the slow pull in. Let's talk. Let's read letters from colonists before we talk about what the CPU clock speed is. So and also, of course, the obligatory holiday gift guides are coming out this week.
Wonderful. And Serenity Caldwell, thank you so much for joining us as well. You're a panelist on the Incomparable podcast, and you are the manager of editors over at iMore.
One manager of editors. I'm joined by Peter Cohen, who is the manager of Mac editors.
I see. And what are you guys working on this month?
Oh, we're working on tons of really exciting stuff. We're revamping a little bit about how we do content. So look for a lot more stuff on apps, including stuff by yours truly to come out soon. We've got a ton of gift guide stuff that's already up that we launched over Black Friday. And I hear rumors that we might be doing ebooks.
That's an interesting rumor. You heard it here first.
You need to have some sort of an expert on staff who knows ebooks. It's a fool's game you're getting into, Serenity.
Wait
a minute. It's one of the greatest experts in. Okay.
Don't give away my secret identity, Andy.
Does that mean that now I can't hit you up for free advice on putting together my own ebooks? That's fine. I should have been paying you anyway. That's all right. And I will still give you the giant Toblerone box that I was going to give you for Christmas.
Oh, Merry Christmas to you.
It's only December 2nd. Come on. Merry Christmas. Allison Sheridan is at the Nozilla Mac podcast. Thank you so much for jumping in. We pulled you in at the last second. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing with us. What else is going on with you besides the Nozilla Mac podcast?
It's actually NozillaCast Mac podcast. I've managed to work it in twice, but I'm going to do it a third time. This week will be gratuitous excitement about having done 500 shows. My one strength is that I come out with the show absolutely every Sunday night. If I'm ever going to be late, I'll make sure the previous one's early, that kind of thing, to make it all wash out. Been going 9.5 years, and it's kind of just going to be a big old gratuitous yay party this coming Sunday. But in general, the show is, like I said, a Mac bias, but we do stuff on accessibility. I'm really interested in tools for the blind. I've done reviews of things like the Nokia 635 Windows phone that I actually really kind of liked. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on the show, but it's a lot of fun, and it is a tech show, but it is very, very Mac biased for sure.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again for coming in on short notice. I really appreciate it. Great to see the chat room loves you.
And fun to finally get to talk to you directly and to Serenity. I'd never met Serenity before. So hi, Serenity.
Yes.
Hi, Allison.
And of course, everybody's met Andy. All right. Well, we do Mac Break Weekly at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC every single Tuesday right here on the Twit Network. You can watch live at live.twit.tv or subscribe on iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, and many other options. You can choose your favorite at twit.tv. So get to work. Break time is over.